As you found out last night, I don't like standing still. I'm kind of a mover and a shaker, so I didn't do any shaking last night, so that was probably good. Let's bow for a word of prayer once again and ask God to guide this session as well. Lord, again, we're just so thrilled that we can celebrate your sufficiency, your character, your person. And there's one thing that has been uttered numerous times through the last 2 days is that you are real, that you are there, that you are sufficient, that you have the answers. And we are desperate and openly admit that we want to depend on you, that we want our faith to be grown. And sometimes that's very uncomfortable. It's painful. You tell us in your word that the discipline that you give us in order to refine us is often very painful. It's not easy to go through. And we just want to know your presence and be able to grow in you. And I pray for this time that your spirit, you would have reign in our hearts and that my words would be guided and make it this often confusing and difficult subject clear. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you again for the opportunity to share with you today. And so what I want to do in this session, and again, I just want to remind you, we don't have time to go fully into all the nuts and bolts. And some of you have asked, the books that I've written are available on Amazon.com as well as BarnesandNoble.com. Excuse me, they've given me an author page and all that, so you can kind of see them all laid out there. And those are available there. I think The Truth About ADHD is in the lobby as well for those of you who pre-registered and all that. So today, last night, we kind of saw a foundational basis of why evolutionists must have pharmakeia as one part of dependence to answer these life issues. And we saw that it contrasted directly with the Holy Spirit. So today I want to go a step further, and not that we're going to abandon Scripture, okay? So don't misunderstand me. But sometimes there's a roadblock in our road in order to get to the right destination, and that roadblock has to be removed. And that's what we're going to talk about in this session. What exactly are drugs doing? What exactly are these drugs doing? Are they drugs, or are they actually medications? In other words, they're healing agents. And as most of you know, these are widely purported to be, both in media and in general population, to be medications, right? That's how they're perceived. So let's look at entheogenic or psychoactive psychotropic drugs as we get going here. Just as a reminder, Dr. Alan Francis was the chair of the DSM-IV. He was in charge of the DSM-IV, considered to be the most powerful psychiatrist at the turn of the century. And in his book, Saving Normal, he actually talks about the pharmaceutical company and how corrupt they are all throughout. He says, the legal psychiatric drug industry has thrived through the aggressive spread of misinformation. Okay, that's another word for deception, right? Anything that is deceitful comes right from this is not a neat little saying, right from the pit of hell. So John tells us, Christ tells us specifically that Satan is the father of all lies. We know if someone is lying, it doesn't come from anywhere else but from Satan himself. So he goes on, Big Pharma has almost unlimited financial resources, political punch, marketing prowess, and greed in the pursuit of new markets and bigger profits. I don't think I have to even lay this out. The information is just so widespread that pharmaceutical companies are making billions and billions and billions of dollars. I've read numerous psychiatrists and actually neurologists that focus on the point that pharmaceutical companies actually are not focused on drugs that will actually heal people. The money is made in getting people dependent for a lifetime on a drug. And so they actually focus their attention on those things. Now, without mentioning names publicly, I will tell you that I know a CEO of a large pharmaceutical company that has contacted me, and He has been in a battle with the FDA over a drug that would help people with autoimmune diseases, but it would also incredibly hurt Big Pharma. And their drugs are destroying the nervous system of those who take it. And he's offering something that has minimal side effects. Now, the good news is Trump just cleaned house in the FDA. And this hasn't been in the news, but he just cleaned house. And my friend actually feels now that there's a very good opportunity that the drug can go through. So that would be great. But the corruption isn't just in the medical field. It's in the politicians. I don't know if you know this, but for example, in vaccinations, you cannot sue the pharmaceutical company over vaccinations. There's been laws passed by people who have received large sums of money that they're the only business in America that is protected from lawsuits. It is that controlled. I mean, they're all in this together. The FDA is actually funded by pharmaceutical companies in large part. It's that bad. So it is so corrupt and so deceptive what's going on. That's where we're at. And again, this is widely understood in the pharmaceutical industry. So let's look at the father again of psychopharmacology. I mentioned him to you last night, but I just want to reiterate this because this is important. History is vital to understanding what's going on. Dr. Elliot Valenstein, who's a neuroscientist, in his book, Blaming the Brain, The Truth About Drugs and Mental Health, he actually says it was none other than Emil Kraepelin, the architect of modern psychiatry prior to Nazi rule, who fathered psychopharmacology. The historian, the highest regarded historian for madness in psychiatry, Ed Shorter, says in his book, A History of Psychiatry, in the 1880s, Kraepelin himself conducted the first systematic research on the effect of drugs upon the brain, coining the term pharmacopsychology, though he saw no therapeutic application for the technique. So the whole idea of psychopharmacology was born out of Emil Kraepelin's theory of brain dysfunction, eugenics, now called genetics, and by the way, they're no different. This is a side note, but there's a book written in 2011 by the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health called Mental Illness, Racism, and Sexism. And if you read it, your jaw just drops because he's going through and showing how they are. I'll give you a case in point. So guess what the DSM says that the number one people labeled as ADHD are? Caucasian boys, 2-1 over any other group, all right? Now think about this. Ritalin and Adderall are stimulants. Stimulants are known to be performance enhancement drugs. So if a child, a Caucasian boy, is not excelling in his academic performance, and by the way, that's why drugs are given, right? Well, he's not doing well in school. Give him drugs. It's a stimulant. It's a performance enhancement. Do you know what groups are being diagnosed as schizophrenic and given antipsychotics, which we're going to talk about in a minute? Latinas and African Americans, left and right. The laws in every state say that I don't even have to prove that you have a mental illness. As a policeman, as a doctor, if I feel that you are mentally ill, I can put you in jail or I can confine you to the mental ward like that. Those are the laws. Okay. A month ago, I got a call from a family. I had been introduced to the problem. And the next day, I'm sorry, it was a week later, he was going to get shots. He had an anxiety attack, the son did. And I got the call from the dad. He was just, I mean, I could hardly understand it. He was shaking so badly. And he basically said that the psychiatrist and the DSS worker at the hospital, because he had assaulted the physician who was trying to give him the shots, told them that if he didn't take the antipsychotics and they didn't let him ship him off 3 hours away to another hospital, that they were going to take his child away. And he was, I mean, I just, my heart went out to him. So these are the kind of things that are going on behind the scenes. And Alaska is the only state that this is an exception to. And there's actually a court case on the records that you can look up, and I mentioned it in my books, but the judge and then the jury, because it went actually to the Supreme Court, ruled that antipsychotics destroy people's bodies and that they could not be administered without the permission of the patient. That's the only state right now that allows that. So this is a big control issue, even like it was in Nazi Germany. All right, so moving forward here, Brain Research Bulletin. This is put out by the National Institutes of Health, all right? With the triumph of eugenic ideas and the imposition of the racial hygiene policy by Nazi regime, various organs of the German health system saw themselves involved in a perverse system of social control in which the illicit use of psychopharmacological tools became customary. By the way, I want to go back to what I was saying about different ethnic groups being picked on. Do you know who the face of the American Psychiatric Association is? Benjamin Rush. That name should be familiar, right? One of our founding fathers. He's called the father of American psychiatry. And his proposition was that African Americans were mentally ill and that slavery was the remedy. That's the face of the American Psychiatric Association. And this is not discussed, is it? I could go on and on, but it's really disturbing when you start looking at the whole control mechanism that's going on. And this came right out of Nazi Germany, so we shouldn't expect anything different. So let's actually look at the drug theory of these psychoactive or entheogenic drugs. There's only four types of psychoactive drugs, and I've got them up here for you. They're stimulants, and their actual effect is to heighten the senses. And by the way, how do we normally get our senses heightened? Okay, so if we have smells, our senses are activated, right? They change the levels. If we see something, if we hear something, if we're touched. So in other words, God made the senses to accumulate information and process that. This is one of the reasons why autism is such a problem, because these kids, and even into adulthood, have sensory processing issues. In other words, some of them aren't hearing or able to communicate as they should in a normal way. There's a valid neurological problem versus and I don't have time to go into the whole thing about autism, but I'll just leave that one alone for now, because we're going to get on a rabbit trail that we don't need to get on right now. But anyway, they heighten senses. So these drugs actually come in and they do what we're supposed to do in a normal setting, and they heighten our senses. Depressants do the exact opposite. They actually impair how you feel, how you perceive. In other words, they dampen what it is to be a human. They actually suppress what the nervous system is supposed to do. Opioids produce a euphoric state. And of course, opioids are used as pain control mechanisms often in hospitals, and they work very well, like morphine, for example. Hallucinogens alter states of consciousness. So an example of a hallucinogen is LSD or magic mushrooms. And I mentioned last night that they're advocating now that hallucinogens are the new thing. And I'll explain why a little more today, because I want to take the time to do this. So their theory is, let's use PTSD as an example, and I call it PTS without a D. I've been calling that for several years now, and more and more people are starting to use it. We're not disordered if we react to horrific and traumatic events. We should expect that. In fact, the psychiatrist who survived the Holocaust, Viktor Frankl, said, "An abnormal response to an abnormal circumstance is normal." And I love that. What's disordered is when a little child gets raped. That's disordered. What's disordered is when a father comes home and beats his little boy to a pulp. That's disordered. We should expect that child to have major mental struggles. And yet, as a society, we're content just to go, well, we don't know how to deal with the deception, the delusions, the hallucinations in their life, so let's just label them and drug them. And instead of looking them as normal in how they really are. So their theory is, in post-traumatic stress that these people have gone through traumatic events. So if the traumatic event, and this is the whole nurture idea that they argue, genetic determinism, if the bad experience caused this mental turmoil, then what do we need to provide for them? Let's provide a euphoric experience, right? And then that'll reverse all this illness, quote unquote, that they have. So they're actually writing huge articles now. The most prominent psychiatrist saying these guys are going into transcendent states, words they use, and having mystical spiritual experiences that are just changing their life and their outcome and their worldview. I'm quoting what they're saying. So they're actually advocating that the trauma, they can't help themselves, and then we give them this experience, and it's a spiritual experience like no other, and it's healing. Scary. It is scary what they're actually advocating. So magic mushrooms are going to be used as most likely as medical medicines very, very soon here. All right, so there's actually only two theories of drug action. Most people have never heard of drug action, okay? If you're a doctor, you have. If you're a pharmacologist, you definitely have. And essentially is, the question is, what does a drug do? Not what we're told it does. What is a drug actually doing? So the first example is the disease-centered theory. The second is the drug-centered theory. Let me back up here. So let me start with the disease-centered theory. So let's say that I have a headache, okay? Headache is a valid physical problem that we have, right? So the headache, in order to remedy it, we have produced what? Aspirin, Tylenol, ibuprofen, et cetera, right? Excedrin? That was no pun intended there. Okay, so we treat the physical malady with a drug. And so that's the disease-centered theory. In other words, there is a disease here that we've identified. We do this with cancer, right? So here's cancer, so there's chemotherapy. You following what I'm saying here? Okay? And we're on a constant quest when we find a disease to find the remedy of it. And there's also a part of this where when we find a disease, we start trying to find a preventative, which is wise, right? And that's what vaccines, that's the theory of vaccinations, is let's introduce the disease in a controlled way. Hopefully it won't actually take place. So the disease-centered theory definitely works when we're talking about valid, proven physical diseases, when there's biological markers. What about the disease-centered model when it comes to the invisible diseases, quote-unquote, and I'm quoting from Lieberman last night, the invisible diseases of the mind? Can you treat the mind with drugs? And of course, we went through a little bit of that, the philosophy and things last night. And this is actually how this whole idea was born. So the whole idea was born that it actually came out of LSD. When LSD was discovered, they realized when they gave it to what they called mad patients, or now called psychotic or schizophrenic patients, they realized that these people, when they came back around, had a different mindset. Oh, we figured out a healing mechanism. And so they believed that they had found a cure to a disease. And that has not stopped, even though it's obvious that LSD doesn't heal anything, right? So with every drug that was introduced, the concept of disease-centered theory of drug action for mental illness grew. And the pharmaceutical companies have run with this. The drug-centered theory says, no, these drugs do one thing. So if you give it to Joe, you give it to Susie, it doesn't matter who you give it to, that drug will do what that drug does. Now, just as a disclaimer, obviously each of us have a different temperament for drugs. So some of you can take 3 ibuprofen, it doesn't help you. You have to take like 8 and kill your kidneys and, you know, all that, right? Even those who drink alcohol, some people can drink 1, some others need 8 to be drunk, you know, type thing, okay? So I'm not suggesting that drugs do the same thing to everyone. What I am saying is drugs do the same thing to everyone on the different, you know, how we're made, the different tolerance levels. So I'll give you a case in point. If you take Ritalin, it will affect you the exact same way whether you're labeled or not labeled as ADHD. It will. This is a proven fact. In fact, Ritalin is called kiddie cocaine. It's the number one abused drug in the world. If it's injected or snorted, it actually is cocaine. It's the exact same chemical makeup. You can Google this. It is all over medical literature. They have done tests. So what they did was they actually took cocaine. You can't sell cocaine. It's a Schedule 1. Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 are the same category. They're the most dangerous drugs that we have. The FDA has classified them as such. So Schedule 1 are illicit or illegal drugs. And the reason is because they're public domain. So marijuana, for example, cocaine, for example, LSD, all these are found in nature. Schedule 2 are actually privatized. Doesn't mean they're all that different. It's just that different components have been synthesized. So they actually take elements from the real thing, they synthesize it, they rename it, rebrand it. And a lot of these actually, they only have patents for 12 years. And by the way, it's kind of funny, I do photography as well and subsidize my bad habit of writing and speaking. And I actually shot a CEO of a large pharmaceutical company's penthouse, $1.6 million penthouse he owns in Greenville. And he lives in California. And he doesn't know my background, so I was asking him questions. I thought, this is going to be fun. So I started asking him about, you know, these drugs, and it was right when the AIDS pill came, you know, the big controversy of raising the price and this and that. And he just goes into, oh, the public doesn't know, and the media just has jumped on this. He said, people don't know that we only have a patent for 12 years, and it actually takes us about 7 years to get approval. And I said, really, is that accurate? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, we hardly make any money. And I said, well, I know that's not true. And he said, well, we make money, but we could make so much more. And I said, well, how long did it take to get Adderall to be approved? And this is his company. He said, I don't really know. And I said, it only took 3 months. They only did 3 months of clinical trials. If you read any prominent theorist on ADHD, guess what they say? We don't know the long-term effects of stimulants on kids. You can't with 3 months of clinical trials. This is a proven fact. They are guessing at this and hoping. And we're starting to see, I was sharing with somebody before, the literature is showing study after study that these kids that are on long-term are actually, your nervous system can't be on a euphoric high that long and it crashes. And it creates a depressed state, and many kids are being diagnosed as bipolar and depressed because of being on a euphoric state, not being able to sleep because their senses are heightened, and at some point you're going to crash. And a lot of these kids are actually killing themselves. With every single shooting that we've had, major shooting in the United States in the last 10 years, drugs have been directly associated with it. Take, for example, the Orlando shooting. You hear that he was bipolar. You don't hear that he was on a heavy antipsychotic drug, right? Nobody's talking about it. And there's a direct correlation with these shootings, these killings, and messing with our nervous system. So we have this whole concept of the disease-centered theory versus the drug-centered theory. So let's look at what some of the psychiatrists say. So Dr. Joanne Moncrief, in her book, The Bitterest Pill, she actually goes through antipsychotics. So she focuses on the drug antipsychotic. Really good book. The disease-centered model of drug action is based on the idea that drugs work by acting on the apparent biological processes, be it chemical imbalances or other abnormalities, which are assumed to produce the symptoms of a particular disorder. According to this view, drugs make the body more normal by helping to reverse an underlying disease or dysfunction. This action on the disease process is the drug's therapeutic action, and all its other actions are designated as side effects and considered to be secondary importance. By the way, let me just stop here and say this to you. When you read side effects with psychoactive substances, those are often the actual drug action. So on antidepressants, on the bottle has the black box warning that says causes suicidal ideation on all antidepressants. That's actually what the drug does. Okay, it's not a side effect. It is the drug's action, which is really scary if you think about it. If you frame the drug's action as a side effect, people will buy into what you're trying to say the drug is doing. Okay. All right, so moving along. Another psychiatrist, Robert Taylor, in his book, and by the way, he endorses taking drugs, and so does Joanne Moncrief, okay? I want you to be clear on that. These are not psychiatrists who are going, maybe we shouldn't use drugs. They're saying, why are we doing this? We need to think through that. I'm not saying don't do it. So he's saying finding the right psychiatrist, a guide for consumers. In the absence of any real progress, psychodrug makers have relied on marketing gimmicks. By far the most successful one portrays psychodrugs as treatment for specific chemical imbalances in the brain. Stupid question. How many of you have heard of the chemical imbalance theory, right? All right. So let's talk about that a little bit today. And before we do this, I cannot tell you how many people I have presented these facts to, and I'm not going to give you all of them today, of course, but the literature is overwhelming. It is overwhelming. Psychiatrists are realizing there is no such thing as a chemical imbalance. The general population doesn't. And no matter what we tell people, they are so deluded, they are so grasped on to deception that they're not willing to give that thought up. Okay? Now let's look at what actually is going on here. This is Ronald Pais. He's the editor-in-chief of the Psychiatric Times, the most prestigious psychiatric journal. Okay? He wrote an article in 2011. I am not one who easily loses his temper, but I confess to experiencing markedly increased limbic activity. I love how he says this, right? Whenever I hear someone proclaim, psychiatrists think all mental disorders are due to chemical imbalance. In the past 30 years, I don't believe I've ever heard a knowledgeable, well-trained psychiatrist make such a preposterous claim, except perhaps to mock it. On the other hand, the chemical imbalance trope has been tossed around a great deal by opponents of psychiatry, who maliciously attribute the phrase to psychiatrists themselves. And yes, the chemical imbalance image has been vigorously promoted by some pharmaceutical companies, often to the detriment of our patients' understanding. In truth, the chemical imbalance notion was always a kind of urban legend, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists. Have you heard that on the news lately? No? Okay. Let's keep going. This is Dr. Irving Kirsch, researcher and professor of medicine at Harvard University. The conventional view of depression is that it's caused by chemical imbalance in the brain. You may be surprised to learn that it is actually a rather controversial theory and that there is not much scientific evidence to support it. It is not just that there is not much supportive evidence. Rather, there is a ton of data indicating that the chemical imbalance theory is simply wrong. Let's look at another one. This is Ronald Pais again, okay? This is another article. Of course, there certainly are psychiatrists and other physicians who have used the term chemical imbalance when explaining psychiatric illness to a patient or when prescribing a medication for depression or anxiety. Why? Many patients who suffer from severe depression or anxiety or psychosis tend to blame themselves for the problem. They have often, guilt, they have often been told by family members that they are weak-willed or just making excuses when they get sick, that they would be fine if they just picked themselves up by their proverbial bootstraps. They are often made to feel guilty for using a medication to help them with their mood swings or embarrassed. So some doctors believe that they will help the patient feel less blameworthy by telling them, you have a chemical imbalance causing your problem. It's easy to think you're doing the patient a favor by providing this kind of explanation, but often this isn't the case. Now that's called a lie, okay? Now, I do want to say this. I want you to think through this. If a delusion is a false, fixed belief, and as a psychiatrist, you're lying to your patients to the point where when facts are given, they say, no, chemical imbalance is real. And you're as a psychiatrist, you're saying, it's actually not real. We were just trying to help your guilt. You're actually creating a delusion. You're creating a false, fixed belief. You're not helping them. You're actually giving them the very idea of mental illness that you're saying you're trying to treat. Scary, isn't it? And this is when you start deceiving people, you have to keep deceiving people. And that's what's going on with this. They're giving them false hope because they don't have the answers. Psychiatrist Peter Bregan, Dr. Bulkley mentioned him last night. He was a full-time consultant for the National Institutes of Mental Health. He was the head professional witness on the Columbine shootings. He was brought in as the expert witness. He is another Harvard psychiatrist, now retired. And he says in his book, this is a paper he wrote that's I just absolutely love. This was last year. Many professionals in the public have been falsely convinced that biochemical imbalances in the brain drive mental suffering, such as the serotonin theory of depression or the dopamine theory of so-called schizophrenia. Yet the evidence for any biological basis for psychiatric disorders is utterly lacking. He actually says in his book, Toxic Psychiatry, he says, we've told people they have a chemical imbalance, so we give them a drug and actually create a chemical imbalance. So this is the kind of thing that is going on in our day and age. We bought into it. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail because I want to keep moving here, but I do feel it's good for me to say this to you. There is no test at all that can measure the chemicals of someone's brain right now. That's number one. Number two, there is no normative standard for just the people in this room, let alone all humanity. Okay? There's no balanced chemicals. Third of all, every single thought we have, and neuroscience is showing this left and right, every thought we have changes both the chemical structure of our brain, but also the actual size. You can atrophy your brain if you're not thinking positively and correctly. And by the way, getting goosebumps every time I say this, Scripture actually says that, doesn't it? Proverbs 3, Proverbs chapter 4, my son, if you receive my wisdom, it will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. There's actually a medical term now called psychoneuroimmunology and another one called epigenetics. And they're discovering in secularism that every single thought we have changes our immune system, changes our neurological system. It is so powerful that they've come to realize that we've got it all backwards. In fact, one of the no pun intended, the craziest books I read was called Molecules of Emotion by Dr. Candace Pert. Now, Dr. Candace Pert was the head of neurochemistry at the National Institute of Health. It's the highest neuroscience position you can have in the United States. And when she retired, she wrote this book, Molecules of Emotion. And she's actually saying, we've been taught that the brain is this central computer, and we're starting to realize that's completely bogus. The brain is just one organ. And she goes through example after example that they're now realizing the immune system, even the gut, even the external nervous system is sending the signals to the brain. The brain is learning from them and then sends the signal out to the rest of the body. This is not the central nervous system that we once thought. It is fascinating. And she actually advocates that we've got to get back to a dualistic view of man. Now, she's not a Christian. She's an atheist. But she's starting to understand, and she actually says this in her book, some people call this the Holy Spirit. I was like, what? You know, you want to call these people up and say, let's go get coffee and talk about this, because you're starting to realize something, and, you know, let God work in your life and get truth here. But science is showing this whole idea just to be complete baloney. So there's no way to measure. And again, if they could measure, changing your thoughts will change your chemical levels. That's how God designed the body. And I'm gonna skip through this because it's the same stuff just for time's sake. All right, let me read you two quotes here. First is Dr. Jerome Frank, who was professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University. Psychotherapy may be the only treatment that creates the illness it treats. And by the way, that's published by the American Psychological Association, okay? You can't make this stuff up. This is Dr. Alan Francis again, who I've already shared with you was the head of the task force of the DSM-4. He says, we saw the DSM-4 as a guidebook, not a Bible, a collection of temporarily useful diagnostic constructs, not a catalog of real diseases. I'm going to tell you this. Most psychiatrists do not actually believe that they're dealing with illnesses. They're not dealing with illnesses. And tomorrow, I'm going to go through ADHD, but I'll just hint at it now. You don't have to have any medical experience, any biology background to diagnose someone with ADHD. Do you realize that? Because you're actually just talking about behaviors. If you can watch someone's behaviors, you can diagnose ADHD. And that's true for most psychiatric disorders. It's not a medical issue at all. And here is one of the most powerful psychiatrists at the turn of the century saying, these are not real diseases. Daniel's not saying that. They're saying that. Okay. And still I have people look me in the face and go, no, it is. Because faith is what this is all about. It's not science. There is no science. And believe me, I have spent almost 12 years diligently looking for any science that could prove me otherwise. And I actually tried to go the other route because I couldn't find answers from people I respected about schizophrenia, about bipolar. I thought maybe there's legitimacy here. So I went that way and went immediately back over when I started reading. They had no clue what they were talking about. And they admit that. All right, so here's the National Institutes of Mental Health. Medications treat the symptoms of mental disorders. They cannot cure the disorder, but they make people feel better so that they can function. How many of you want to feel better? I do. Yeah? Sleep also makes you feel better. Being right with God definitely makes you feel better. So, I mean, what do we look at as medication? Is it feeling better? Is it coping? Is it getting through? Or is medication actually attempting at least to heal something? You understand what I'm saying? The National Institute of Mental Health is just one example. They understand these are not healing mechanisms. How much time do we have, by the way? 15.
20 minutes.
Should I trust him?
Yeah.
I got 20 minutes.
Does he have a chemical imbalance or?
No.
All right. So what is the drug's true action? All drugs impact the brain. Again, this is Dr. Peter Bregan. In mind, they work by partially